loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, Donald Trump signed an executive order yesterday after highly contested policies of separating families at the border drew national and international condemnation. But what does the executive order do and what does it not do? Then the U.S.-Korea summit in Singapore took place last week. It was momentous. It resulted in four agreed-upon goals. And despite negative Western media, at least two of them are in the works. Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, went to China for the third time in as many months. Moon Jae-in is in Moscow, prepared to meet with Vladimir Putin tomorrow. We're going to talk about prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula. And then our regular Thursday segment called Criminal Injustice with Paul Wright and Kevin Gostala. This comes to Loud and Clear listeners every Thursday, where we talk about the criminal injustice system in the United States.
But before we get to those three stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, 9 months after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, the island's government has moved to privatize and upgrade its outdated electrical grid. Next, Sarah Netanyahu, the wife of Israel's prime minister, was charged today with felony counts of fraud and breach of trust. She's accused of spending more than $100,000 on meals at the prime minister's residence and $10,000 on private chefs for herself. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 8 years in prison. Then, an East Pittsburgh police officer is being accused of shooting and killing 17-year-old Antoine Rose after the youth fled a car the officer had pulled over. Video of the incident shows Rose being shot in the back. He was unarmed. Protests against police violence continued in Pittsburgh today. And then Church and State, The Israel Experiment, is an upcoming film by Netra Halperin, a Hollywood producer and director with a concern for peace and equality. The filmmaker joins us in the studio to talk about it. And finally, 1 year after Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud was elevated to Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as well as defense minister, his war in Yemen rages on, while MBS, as he's known in the West, maintains an ongoing charm offensive here. His policies threaten the lives of millions of Yemenis, at least 8 million of whom are currently at risk of starvation. And all of that is in the name of curbing Iranian influence in the region. And in other headlines, Turkey and India today announced retaliatory tariffs on the United States, responding to the Trump administration's duties on steel and aluminum. Each country's trade measures were worth approximately $250 million. Tomorrow, new European Union tariffs on $3.24 billion of U.S. goods will go into effect. The leaders of Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia announced today that they will be boycotting an upcoming summit on the refugee crisis in Europe. The four countries are well known for their anti-immigrant policies. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, who leads a far-right government, also attended the meeting but did not announce a boycott. The vote on the so-called moderate House immigration bill was delayed today amidst concerns that it would fail. The bill would have brought back the Obama-era policy of keeping families together but still in detention facilities, which were also protested at the time. It would also provide $25 billion for the president's border wall, impose limits on legal immigration, and lay out a pathway for citizenship. The Supreme Court ruled today that states are allowed to require online companies to charge state sales tax on goods shipped to addresses in their states. The legal challenge was brought by large online retailers Wayfair, Overstock, and Newegg against a South Dakota law and was decided on a 5-4 vote. A federal report puts possible tax collection at $13 billion annually. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the issue of immigration. President Trump yesterday signed an executive order reversing his policy of separating refugee migrant children from their parents. The policy drew across-the-board condemnation from Democrats and Republicans and independents alike, although it was also seen as a political sop to Trump's right-wing base. We'll look at what's next for asylum seekers, including immigrants and their families. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan Jose, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian and John.
Juan Jose, let's first talk about what this what this executive order does and what it doesn't do.
Well, what it does is that in a very undefined way, remains to be seen what happens. Parents and undocumented parents and their children are going to be allowed to remain together through the duration of their legal proceedings before an immigration judge. And of course, that represents an immediate legal problem, because children under the Flores Agreement, which was a federal court decision, they worked out a deal to deal with children in detention, states that no child can be detained beyond 20 days in any immigration detention center. So under the Donald Trump executive order signed yesterday, he's calling for that decision to be undone by the federal courts so that children can be detained with their parents indefinitely. So some of us are thinking that that's a worse scenario than having children separated from their parents when they had an expectation that they could be freed 20 days from the day that they're first incarcerated.
Okay, so and that's one huge problem. If we're setting up family imprisonment indefinitely, or at least until the process comes to an end, and Juan Jose, how long does a process last?
Well, that's a very good question. That's not a question that can be answered definitively, because a proceeding can take as little as going to the first court hearing and basically agreeing, that you're here in the country illegally and that you want to be returned to your country of origin. And then the case can be closed and then you're deported. But where people choose to fight their cases, as in most cases, we suspect most of the detainees would want to do, the adult detainees, they're coming here seeking refuge and political asylum. There's a court proceeding for that, and that could take years. So having children incarcerated with their parents, for years, that's something that definitely is not only inhumane, immoral, it's unacceptable, and we're going to do everything we can, and I'm sure that many, many other people around the country are thinking the same way. We have to do everything we can to make sure that that does not happen.
Juan Jose, the Washington Post is reporting today that the Border Patrol will no longer refer migrant parents who cross into the U.S. illegally with children over to federal courthouses to face criminal charges. That sort of flies in the face of this so-called zero tolerance policy. Does this executive order take us back to the Obama policy, or is this something different?
Well, we don't know. I mean, under the Constitution, every person charged with an offense has a due process right to go before a court. And so when the immigration authorities go on record stating that they will no longer allow people to avail themselves of that constitutionally guaranteed right, well, then where are they going to go? Are they all going to be left in these modern-day concentration camps, and somebody's going to go there, an administrative judge, essentially an immigration agent with authority to hear their cases and then basically expedite the proceeding and come up with a decision which we would suspect that under the circumstances would be contrary to the interest of the child and the parent, and get them deported? I mean, that's up in the air. We don't know if that's what this executive order, that's the direction this executive order wants to take us in. But that's unacceptable. I mean, if you come here and you want to petition for political asylum protection or for refugee status protection, you have a right to go before a judge. I don't believe that right can be taken away by executive order in violation of the Constitution of the United States.
Let's talk about how we got here. In 2014, the Obama administration was opening family detention centers for the undocumented. Now, at that time, progressive people were organizing protests against family detention. Then you have the Trump administration using immigrants as basically opportunistically as a punching bag and establishing this zero tolerance policy and treating everyone who crossed the border as a criminal, and a lot of people forced to plead to lesser charges and then have that on the record, still hoping that they would go forward in an asylum process. Then masses of people, because there was a media spotlight on the separation of children, millions of people wanted to change this policy. So under pressure, Donald Trump yesterday signs an executive order saying, oh, people are going to be very happy, in Trump's words. I'm sure they are, because we're going to keep families together. So then, and some of the organizations like Move On, who are like more or less Democratic Party front groups who are organizing protests, were really not demanding justice for asylum seekers, simply that families should not be separated. So now Donald Trump seems to acquiesce and say, yeah, let's keep the families together, but locked up. I mean, that's not a good outcome.
That's not a good outcome. And again, this executive order leaves a lot more questions than answers on what happens to detained children and their parents. You know, at the beginning of the executive order, if you read it carefully, you know, you have to wonder what he means where Donald Trump or his lawyers wrote that, you know, that it is the policy of this administration to maintain family unity, including by detaining alien families together where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources. In other words, he says nothing in his executive order, Donald Trump, about what's going to happen to the over 2,000 kids that have been taken from their mothers. There's no timetable, or there's no description of what the authorities are, immigration authorities are directed to do to redress this forced and inhumane separation of mother and children. We don't know what's going to happen to those 2,300 plus children that are presently separated, or their mothers, if they're ever going to be reunited at all. It almost, if you read this, you know, this order carefully, it almost reads as if Donald Trump is saying, going forward, we're going to do what we can to keep families together, as long as, of course, we have the available resources to do so. And so he directs, you know, any number of government agencies to basically start working with other government departments like the armed forces to basically start building or making existing facilities available to expand, you know, this concentration camp syndrome, you know, that's that's presently plaguing the country. So I'm very concerned about what's going on, and I'm more concerned that some people, some liberals, are already celebrating what happened yesterday as though it is a huge political victory. And henceforth, children and their parents are not going to be subject of suffering and injustice. My feeling is that this does nothing to resolve the issue. And I think that keeping children and their parents incarcerated for an indefinite period of time is a lot worse than keeping parents and children separated, where children at least had a chance to be released to some family member, you know, 20 days after, you know, they're being incarcerated.
Juan Jose, I want to ask you a political question in the last few minutes that we have. The press has made much of this being Donald Trump reaching out yet again to his political base. But at the same time, so many Americans have compared this policy with the policy of detaining Japanese Americans during the Second World War, or even the policies coming out of Nazi Germany to round up Jews and gypsies and others. How in the world can this policy, whether it's the one that we had yesterday or the one we have today, be appealing to anybody but the most solidly pro-Trump people? How does Donald Trump come out ahead with either one of these policies?
Well, he comes out ahead with this hardcore reactionary electorate base that he does have supporting him. But I think that for the majority of the American people, we're starting to see, at least, you know, a vast majority of the American public is beginning to see that what Donald Trump is doing with this immigrant kids and their parents is using them as a laboratory, a political laboratory, to do political experimentation, right? Begin implementing and displaying, you know, fascist-like policies that, if left unchallenged, they're going to eventually be used against the American people, those individuals that believe in justice and so on. And so he comes ahead with his base, but as far as the vast majority of the American people, I think that he's hurting himself and his administration. And I think that this awakening that we're beginning to see is not going to stop now. It's very likely that this executive order is going to create more problems that we're going to have to struggle with. And that offers an opportunity, for a real movement to once again arise in America.
30 seconds left, Juan Jose. What's the alternative to incarceration of these families during the asylum process?
They have to be freed, as was the case before. There may be some things that need to be worked out to see how follow up with these individuals so that they don't just get lost in the shuffle. But I think that the Flores decision is a good way to proceed forward. Release the children. It's un-American and immoral to keep them locked up for indefinite periods of time, even if that's done in the company of their parents.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un completed his third trip to China in as many months, where he consulted with the Chinese leadership on next steps with the United States and, obviously, next steps in the relationship between North Korea and the People's Republic of China. President Trump said that since his summit with Kim in Singapore, North Korea has returned the remains of 200 U.S. soldiers missing from the Korean War. And in the United States, a new poll shows that 55% of Americans support Donald Trump's North Korea policy. That's a much higher number than those who support Donald Trump. It's the single most popular policy of the Trump presidency so far. We're joined from London by John Ross, senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, Renmin University of China, and an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. John Ross, welcome back. Let's start real quick with the obviously warming relationship between the DPRK and China. What do you make of this latest visit between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping?
Well, I think this is a continuation really of the first visit. Obviously, very few people know exactly what is discussed between Xi Jinping and the leader of North Korea in detail. But Chongyang's, where I work, is one of the leading think tanks in China, so it knows the general readout, you may say, of the situation. Not the details, of course, but what was the feeling. And ever since the first visit of Kim to China, the reaction has been extremely positive, which is they really think that North Korea really is placing the question of the economy at the forefront and improving living standards, in which case, of course, China's both got a lot to teach and has got a very good opportunity, to play a big role in that. China remains committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, so there's the two aspects of that. But the general take was it's not merely words that North Korea is prioritizing its economic development. That's its real position. It's taken a fundamental view on that, and therefore, it's not terribly surprising to see that there's very close coordination taking place between China and North Korea. Or three visits obviously speaks for itself.
Is there a significance in terms of how Kim and Xi are meeting? I believe they're addressing each other in their positions as the leaders of the Korean Workers' Party and the Communist Party of China not simply as the heads of state. Do you give any significance to that?
Well, yes, certainly, because obviously China's bases its economic system upon, socialism, the Chinese characteristics, as it puts it. And it's also, of course, there is a very strong historical link between North Korea and China, which has got some fraught elements to it. I mean, Korea has, been fighting for its independence from two very powerful neighbors, China and Japan, for about 1,000 years. And that leads to some sensibilities which obviously exist in Korea about independence. You see conflicts also between South Korea and Japan related to the same type of matters. So there are some sensibilities on that. On the other hand, they're both led by communist parties. I mean, I know that the North Korean party is not officially called a communist party, but nevertheless, in all reality, it is a communist party. And that certainly gives them a framework for discussing which goes beyond purely state-to-state relations. The big difference, of course, has been over economic policy and some rhetoric. Big China doesn't go in for the type of denunciations of the United States that North Korean does, etc. It's not China's style. But, China has a very, very successful economic policy. And to be blunt, North Korea did not have a very successful economic policy. And therefore, if North Korea moves closer to China's economic policy, China will be highly pleased about it.
We're speaking with John Ross from London. He's a senior fellow at the Chungnyang Institute, Renmin University of China. And he's an award-winning resident columnist with several different Chinese media organizations. John, I wanted to ask you about some reports in the Western press today that Kim Jong-un is coming out of China with something of a message for the United States from the Chinese leadership, that if the United States wants Chinese help on peace and denuclearization on the peninsula, that they meaning Washington, cannot wage a trade war with China at the same time. Does that sound right to you?
I don't think it would be in that particular form. China is a very big, powerful economy. It can look after itself on the trade front, even without help from North Korea. On the other hand, in the real world, you can't separate the two things. I mean, there's some relative separation, but obviously the United States has asked China to aid it in certain important matters. For example, the sanctions against North Korea. Well, if the United States is going to wage a big trade war with China, why should China do anything other than follow China's most narrow type of interests? So they're not going to be so helpful. It's an objective thing. I don't think, given that China's pattern, they're not using the North Korean question as a pawn in the trade war, because China's capable of looking after itself by other means on that front. But it certainly obviously adds to the atmosphere between the two countries.
John Ross is our guest. We're talking about Korea and Korean relations with China. And also, John, I wanted to ask you about South Korea's relations with Russia, because while Putin invited Kim Jong-un to come to Moscow right after the Singapore summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, Moon Jae-in, the leader of South Korea, has arrived in Moscow in a lead-up to talks with Putin tomorrow. When you look at the whole sort of reshifting and dynamic pace of the current diplomatic schedule, it's pretty profound.
Well, yes. I mean, Russia has an interest. I mean, it shouldn't be called, while North Korea's main border is with China, nevertheless, it has a border with Russia. And who honestly could trust the United States if you had it took over North Korea, which is the perspective that some people in the United States have put forward, that basically that there should be reunification, which is basically South Korea taking over North Korea. I mean, the United States moved its forces into Eastern Europe with NATO, despite the assurances that were given to Gorbachev that it wouldn't. And I can't believe that Russia would be enthusiastic, to put it very mildly, about having America going in North Korea, which means that they would have a border with Russia in the east as well. So I think both Russia and China have got a position whereby they want exactly what they say they want. They want denuclearized Korean Peninsula, because I think that's not in the interest of anybody. And they don't want some takeover by the United States of North Korea. So I think China and Russia have common interest in that. Now, I also, incidentally, don't think that South Korea wants the collapse of North Korea. They think it'd be very dangerous. All the polls in South Korea show the sentiment is that the population greatly welcomes the very much improved relations between North Korea and South Korea, that the scenes which have taken place have been really rather moving, to be quite honest. And therefore, they want a they certainly don't want a war. Which, I mean, the idea of when Trump was talking about using, you know, weapons, etc., horrifies the people of South Korea. And so, therefore, South Korea has also a common interest in coming to very good common positions with Russia also, which says there's a bit of confluence of interests of these groups.
Let me ask you, just to keep pursuing this, that's all true. I mean, that's 100% true, what you said. I wonder whether it might, however, also signify the potential, at least, of a possible, not all at once, but a possible gradual, incremental realignment of politics in the area. South Korea has had, I would say, limited to zero sovereignty in the past. Now appears to be a sort of a semi-independent player, both with North Korea, with Japan, with China, and now with Russia. And of course, if the People's Republic of China is able to find a place for the DPRK, North Korea, as part of its larger One Belt, One Road Eurasian economic integration program, can you envision a South Korea realignment?
Yes, there are limits to it. We've got to be clear. South Korea is not going to break with the United States from the point of view of it feels it needs the U.S. military guarantee. Let's leave aside whether it does or not. It certainly feels it, and that's not going to change. On the other hand, South Korea's economic interests are now much more significant with China than they are with the United States. And in fact, all South Korean governments recently have been very, very clear that they're going to pursue trade in relationships with China. Now, also, if the North Korea makes a turn towards a more sensible economic policy, well, then certainly South Korea, they'll probably be more open up to foreign investment and other types of things. And South Korea can certainly gain very much from that. And therefore, this is certainly increasing South Korea's room for maneuver. And secondly, as I said, the South Korean population is just totally against any idea of war or anything with North Korea. So, yes, there is within limits, but nevertheless, there is more significant room for maneuver of South Korea. Also, Russia would then play an important element in that, because the China and Russia are the two big partners for North Korea.
South Korea is a big economy. It's a very big economy. It's had, as I mentioned, very limited to zero sovereignty in the past. But with this size economy, and if there is any sort of reorganization or realignment, certainly South Korea would be and will be emerging. And of course, if there's some sort, maybe not like an absorption of North Korea, but even as the North Koreans have proposed over the decades, a confederal system of reunification whereby the two social systems stay in place more or less, but there's grounds for some centralized unity, it could be a big game changer. Anyway, 1 minute left, John Ross. Go ahead.
Yes, certainly. I think confederal is a bit, let's say it's not going to happen by the end of the year, let's put it mildly.
You're right about that.
Yeah, but what is the case is, yeah, South Korea has big interest. Obviously, the main economic partners for North Korea, because of their relations, are going to be China and Russia on the one hand and South Korea on the other. That's in the interest of North Korea, but it's also in the interests of South Korea. South Korea has tried to have one economic zone where it works in the north. So, yeah, it's going to be very good win-win situation that can be worked out, not merely for North Korea, but also for South Korea.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by John Ross, Senior Fellow at Chungyang Institute, Renmin University of China. He is also an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. You are listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on the show.
Paul, I'd like to start with you. The Human Rights Defense Center filed a suit today in Florida that, what the suit is about the treatment of a teenager. And he was treated so egregiously in a local jail that it just cries out for justice. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, this is a class action suit. Unfortunately, it's not just one child that they're doing this to. It's all of them. So basically, what the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department does, which runs our local jail, is children that have co-defendants, they place them in solitary confinement for weeks, months, sometimes even years on end, where they're locked in these cells, have no contact with other children, other prisoners, and they're also being denied mental health care. They're also being denied their right to an education, which the Florida Constitution guarantees children. All children are 21, the right to a free public education. So they're not getting that. In addition to suing the sheriff's office, we're also suing the school board as well. And these are all, and this practice has been going on for years. That's what's kind of really, really terrible about it. It's not an isolated instance. It's not a thing where, you know, it just happened one time or it was an accident or whatever, but this is actually an ongoing practice by the sheriff's department to just basically lock these children in solitary confinement and deprive them of pretty much, you know, really basic things like everything from the education to human interaction to mental health treatment. So we filed suit and we're hoping to be able to change this reality. We're hoping that we get these kids out of solitary confinement and see to it that at least, even if they are going to be in custody, that they can at least continue to receive an education as they have a right to, and hopefully we can get it resolved here. But what's shocking is that here we are in 2018, and this is happening, and while there's a lot of attention about immigrant children at the border being torn away from their parents and being sent into abysmal conditions of confinement and being caged, this is also going on around the country. Throughout the country, this is happening, and this is happening here in Florida. And what's especially shocking about this is that of our children clients that we're representing, all of them are children of color. They're all African American, Haitian American, or Latino American, and they're all developmentally disabled. So they all have some type of developmental disability. So, you know, this is a case where you've got kind of, it's a super vulnerable population just by virtue of the fact that they're children. Then you throw in the disabilities on there, and, you know, it's like, it's an especially vulnerable population. And what's shocking is that the situation has continued as long as it has.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. He is the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center that filed the lawsuit. We're also on the phone with Kevin Gastala from Shadowproof. Every Thursday, we talk about criminal injustice in America, the criminal injustice system. Before we go to Kevin, I want to stay, Paul, with you for a moment. I'm looking at My Palm Beach Post. I want to read, and this is about your lawsuit, a couple more sentences. A 16-year-old got his teeth knocked out by deputies after flooding his cell with toilet water when his telephone privileges were cut short. A brief moment, he could have contact with anyone. Other juveniles begged deputies for water but were forced to drink the putrid, discolored water from the sink attached to their toilet. "I'm not your water boy," the deputies barked back. I mean, this is child abuse.
It's child abuse.
It's so disgusting. And again, as we talk about, and why I think this show is important, and why the work of both Kevin and Paul is so important, is the public is basically kept in the dark about all of this. Those are terrible conditions, Paul. Again, rare?
No, unfortunately, very common. basically, we started investigating this when the families of some of the children contacted us, and our lawyers started looking into it, and the more we found, the more egregious it came out. And that was one of those things where we decided that, you know, we needed to do something about it, and that's why we decided to file the lawsuit. But one of the things that I think that in the course of investigating this, we find that this is happening all over Florida, just here in our neck of the woods. This is a very common practice where children are being placed in solitary confinement. And I think it's important to note, they're not being placed in solitary confinement because of anything they've done while they're in jail. It's not because they're assaulting other kids. It's not because they're assaulting the deputies or the staff, or they're not engaging in criminal activity when they're in the jail. They're being stuck in solitary confinement basically for the administrative convenience of the jail. You know, and I think that's one of the things that's really important to note is that, you know, this isn't a case where, you know, where the kids are behaving poorly before they're being put in isolation or solitary confinement. They're being put in isolation. This is an administrative measure by the jail. And in terms of looking around, seeing what's happening in other jails here in Florida, we find that, unfortunately, this is really common. This is happening all over the place. And so this is kind of, you know, we just don't have the resources to do more cases like this. And these cases they're very expensive to bring, they're very time-consuming, and they're complex cases. But unfortunately, the conditions that we're complaining about here in Palm Beach County are not isolated, they're not restricted to just Palm Beach County. They're common, unfortunately, all over the state of Florida, if not the country.
Kevin Gustala, you've reported extensively on solitary confinement around the country, and I think it was maybe a year ago you wrote about solitary confinement for children ending in the state of Ohio. Why hasn't that happened in more states?
I can't speak to why it hasn't happened in states. I mean, it would seem now that we would be able to agree, given all of the studies that have been done on solitary confinement and its impact. The fact that we've had psychologists actually show what happens to people. There's been people like, I think his name's Craig Haney, who has documented quite extensively what happens to people who are put in these conditions. And it would seem to apply to an even greater extent to children, especially since they haven't developed into full-blown human beings yet, that they're still trying to get to the stage that you and I are at currently as adults. And so I'm really struck. I find it really grotesque reading some of this. I just want to specifically mention some of what's in this filing from the lawsuit, because people really need to know that, like, what we're talking about here, for example, is that these are children who are being put into like really ice cold cells without any clothing whatsoever, not even given gowns in order to cover themselves up, left with like a suicide blanket, whatever that might be, definitely uncomfortable and probably impossible for the child to sleep during any night. The sort of abuse where they're not being given clean water and forced to drink toilet water can be hugely damaging, especially, and to a, you know, even a greater extent because they have developmental disabilities. So that's going to cause even more trauma for these children. And I also noticed that one of the plaintiffs is from Honduras originally. So whatever they're going through, you know, I would say there's definitely an element with the way these children that are being treated that probably mirrors and is very similar to the way children are being treated in these camps that we're hearing about, or these big box retail stores that are being converted into detention facilities right now.
Let's talk about that, actually. Paul, much has been made in the press about some of these big box facilities, like former Walmarts, for example, being turned into detention centers. And we see news reports about cages, for example, and people are sleeping with what look like sheets of tinfoil over them. Tell us a little bit about the conditions inside these facilities, and how do they compare to actual prisons?
Well, basically, I think that for better or for worse, these are facilities that weren't designed to be prisons. And I think that, you know, for those of us who have been around for a while, I think we remember Hurricane Katrina and the very first government service that was deemed to be the top priority to get going in New Orleans after after Hurricane Katrina devastated and flooded the local jail was to make a new jail. And to do that, they converted the Greyhound bus station into a jail. So I think there's kind of like a long history of converting everything from soccer stadiums to factories to whatever into makeshift cages. And you know, so I think this is just an extension of that long history of, you know, of doing that. And so I think that, you know, this is just that extension. And frankly, I'm just kind of surprised that the Trump administration hasn't gone gung-ho on using former military bases or even current military bases as makeshift prisons, because I think for some of us who have been around for a while, back in the late 70s and the early 80s, when there was the Mariel boat lift from Cuba, the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration, they kept Cuban refugees in current and former military bases for literally for years after they arrived in this country. So, you know, I think this is just kind of like an ongoing history of repurposing structures or buildings and converting them into, you know, converting them into makeshift jails and prisons. So I think that, you know, this is nothing new, and I guess the only question here really is just how long is this going to continue? How long is this going to go on?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And Kevin, while this is going on, there are a lot of major Trump investors who are making a lot of money on this situation, are they not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'd say that everyone is circling around the Trump administration, and you know, if we're talking about people linked with the well-known private prison entities, ones that we've talked on our show, for example, like Geo Group or even Core Civic, and also probably I'd imagine that the private prison health contractors are looking at this as an opportunity, something that we all should be very concerned about. And I've heard that there's reports about you know, these children that are in these facilities, because there's so many of them, that they're having issues dealing with the way they behave. So they're going to drugging these children so that they can sedate them, basically, and make them easier for the guards to handle or the personnel to handle. And so, you know, like that kind of thing, that service, as inhumane as it is, one of these contractors wants to be involved in having that job.
Yeah. Paul, in your opinion, how much of this is incentivized just by for private profit?
You know, I'm not really sure. I think in some respects, I think that I look at the mass incarceration, the police state is the disease, and private incarceration and private companies profiting from it is merely the symptom. And, you know, and I think that when you start putting it into like the overall economic context, the California Department of Corrections, their budget for this year, last year, was something like $11 billion a year. The entire private prison industry combined is around $3 billion. So they're like, you know, a third of one prison system. And I think that's the big thing about the, you know, about the private prison companies is that, you know, typically they rely on the government contracts. The government comes to them, and yes, there's problems with the private prison industry to the extent that, you know, they'll build prisons on spec, they do lobbying, and they do help push, you know, harsher measures. But at the end of the day, it's the government that's making the decisions. The government's making the decisions to round people up, to arrest them, to cage them. And ultimately, the government's making the decisions on who goes to private prisons or private jails and who stays in a government prison or a government jail. So, you know, so yes, people are profiting from it, but, you know, that just seems to be kind of, at the end of the day, if the government wasn't making the decision to cage people, they would not be profiting from it. And so I think we need to ultimately lay the responsibility for these policies at the hands of the government officials that are making them.
We're speaking with Kevin Gostala and Paul Wright. Kevin joins us from Chicago. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And Paul Wright joins us from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Kevin, I want to switch stories here and talk about an article that appeared in Slate at Slate.com. It's entitled, "A Jury Likely Sentenced a Man to Death Because He's Gay, and the Supreme Court just let its verdict stand." Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so, you know, what we're looking at here is this case of Donovan Schaefer, who robbed a donut shop or was caught, and they alleged that he robbed the shop. And basically, this man turned around and stabbed someone with a knife and killed him. And he confessed to the crime. And then prosecutors went after him for murder. And eventually, he was put on trial. And what the jurors used to contribute to their final decision was the fact that he's a homosexual, or that he had that he was a gay man. And so this factored into their decision. And I would say that, like, we should think of this on par with the way in which you might make an ultimate decision if you were a juror because someone was black or because they happen to have a particular ethnicity. It would definitely be despicable in that respect to give, you know, a black person a higher sentence that you wouldn't give a white individual. And so it would seem to apply in this case that sexual orientation, if that's going into play, and then the fact that we're reading in the Slate article that the Supreme Court has upheld this decision, and then you wonder what's going to be the ripple effect. How much is this going to affect the criminal punishment system that we have in the United States?
You know, one of the things that I just simply didn't understand about this case was why so many people were allowed to testify just about Rhines' sexuality. They had one witness, for example, who testified that she saw Rhines and her husband cuddling. There was another witness who testified that he had had a sexual relationship with Rhines. None of this had anything to do with the crime. And Slate goes on to say that the deliberations went off the rails as soon as the jury went to decide whether he should be sentenced to life without parole death.
One of the jurors, for instance, said since he would be, if he was sentenced to life without parole or sentenced to prison to a male institution, quote, if he's gay, we'd be sending him where he wants to go. So yeah, there's an explanation for why he should be put to death. I mean, it's obviously based on homophobic or anti-gay bigotry.
And there were questions that the jury sent to the judge, like, would he be able to brag about his crime to young men? Would he ever have a cellmate? It's this crazy notion that as a gay man, he would try to recruit people into homosexuality. And so when the judge responded to these questions by saying that he just can't answer them, the jury promptly came back with a death sentence.
So what happens next?
Unfortunately, this is actually kind of common. Just as there's jurisprudence, I mean, there's literally a whole body of jurisprudence about people sentenced to death whose lawyer was asleep. There's a whole body of jurisprudence who were sentenced to death when the judge was asleep. This isn't like, you know, they were dozing off or whatever. I mean, they were like, you know, sound asleep type thing. And there's been other cases where, you know, prosecutors did the same thing. You know, they would make comments about the defendants, about the defendant's homosexuality, and it's literally the same type of thing. It's like, oh, if they're a gay man, sending him to prison is, you know, it's going to be like sending him to day camp or someplace they want to go. So, you know, so there's actually this. Unfortunately, there's a history of this, and in the past, the courts have upheld it. I think Calvin Burdine, I think, was the name of one of the other. He was a defendant in Texas, and he was gay, and his lawyer slept through a lot of the trial. And, you know, I think it's just one of those things where it's just an ongoing, you know, it's just an ongoing thing where, you know, they're just repeatedly, you know, they're just repeatedly doing anything they can to inject bias and prejudice and bigotry into the proceedings. They're not seeking to convict people based on the crime they may or may not have committed. Rather, they're using every, you know, discriminatory and bigoted stereotype or whatever, not just to get the conviction, but to also enhance the punishment. And unfortunately, this is very common around the country. In some respects, it's almost the unusual thing about this is that it actually got some media attention. And the only reason it got the media attention is because there was a petition filed to the Supreme Court about it.
But in the end, there really is no recourse, is there? because on the merits of the case, the Supreme Court has just decided not to hear it.
Correct. So, yes, that's the end of the road. And of course, the amazing thing, though, is that the lower courts that heard it on the merits at this point, by the time he's getting to the Supreme Court, the highest state court in that state has upheld the sentence. And presumably, if he came up through the federal habeas system, it means a federal district court judge and a federal appeals court have also denied him relief as well. So now it's kind of getting, his options are greatly narrowed. So he may still have other potential. I'm not sure what the procedural posture of the entire case is. He may still have other claims that are available to him. But overall, though, I think that, you know, it's definitely not, you know, it's definitely not good for him. And the farther along the litigation goes, the lower the chances are of getting relief.
Right. Let's switch again. We've talked on this show a couple of times over the last year or so about what seems to be an epidemic of cops shooting family pets. I know this isn't a terribly important story for some people, but for others, pets are really family members. And it just seems to be happening more and more. Kevin, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact is that, and I'd say that, again, we have people who are Black, we have people who are brown who are impacted the worst by this, I believe, because there's probably this racist animus towards these individuals that they don't know how to take care of their dogs, or in some cases, I've heard stories of retaliation in the communities where the officers are deciding to shoot the dog because they're upset with how a community might be challenging police brutality, by example. And so we have several instances where there's been efforts to challenge this practice. But, you know, as documented in this criminal legal news article that we're using for our discussion, we've had appeals courts that are allowing this practice to continue, or this act to go unpunished, allowing immunity for these police officers or simply ascribing incompetence to the officers who ended up killing these dogs. And so what happens is you again are taking away any possibility of recourse or accountability or even justice for that matter for the families who are trying to deal with the loss of a pet.
Yeah, in fact, in this article that's published in Criminal Legal News Magazine, it says that the Department of Justice estimates that around 25 to 30 dogs are killed by police every single day, with some numbers as high as 10,000 per year. In Detroit, for example, cops killed at least 25 dogs in 2015, 21 dogs in just the first half of 2016. And in fact, two detectives had killed more than 100 dogs between them over the course of their careers. In Atlanta, cops kill 50 dogs a year. In Buffalo, New York, 92 dogs over 3 years, with one officer having killed 26 dogs in 3 years just by himself. The Justice Department is calling that an epidemic. That seems like an epidemic.
Yeah, and we had that incident, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, African-American gentleman in the community filming on his phone the police arresting somebody. And so they come and they cuff him because he's doing that. It's sort of in a low-rise residential neighborhood. And then the dog jumps out of the car because they're roughing up the dog's owner, and they immediately shoot the dog. It's all gruesome. And most of it, again, sort of not in the public eye. Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to say, I think that part of the reason this is so common and so endemic is I think I think it's linked and goes hand in hand literally with the whole thing of police brutality and police violence. I think that, you know, when police come into a scene and they show that they can and will kill people's pet, and a lot of times, I think it should also be noted, a lot of these pet killings happen in front of children, too. So it's not just that they're coming in with guns drawn and shooting the family pet, they're also shooting it in front of children. And I think that the message that it's intended to send is, you know, we're armed, we're dangerous, we're violent, we can and will kill your pets with impunity. And I think the not so subtle implication is, we just killed your dog in front of you. If you give us any hassle, or resist or aren't docile enough in any way, shape, or form, we're going to kill you too.
The key there too is impunity. What you just said, it's impunity. And it's because police are never, ever prosecuted for doing this because they say the magic words, "I feared for my safety." That's all they have to say, and then it's all over.
Well, some of the ones that are kind of especially egregious is, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a case a couple years ago where the mayor of some suburban small town in Maryland, he was mistakenly arrested as part of a drug ring. It turns out that they got the wrong guy. Federal Express couriers were dropping the drugs off in a box on random people's homes. The police were following the FedEx truck. The guy comes home. There's a box on his doorstep. He picks it up, puts it on the kitchen table, thinking maybe his wife ordered something. And he's in the shower when the police come in and they arrest him naked. And his family had two golden retrievers, and they shot and killed the golden retrievers. And you know, I don't know how familiar people are with dogs, but I don't think I've ever met a mean golden retriever or a vicious golden retriever. They're pretty lovable animals, and you know, if there's any danger, it's that they're overly friendly. And the fact that the cops, they immediately shot and killed his dogs, they arrested the guy and hauled him out of the shower naked, and then it turns out eventually that, oh yeah, this was a big mistake, and he had nothing to do with anything, they shouldn't have arrested him, they shouldn't have killed his dogs. And that got a lot of media attention at the time, but I think that, you know, this comes down to the whole thing of why is the first immediate response, you know, kill the animals? And I think this goes down to the whole thing is this is the police sending a message, is that, you know, they're not going to tolerate any type of resistance or protest or whatever, and they set the tone of the encounter by killing the animal. I mean, you've got the guns going off, you've got a dead animal. And I think that's fair to say, too, though, is that I'd say for most American families that have a pet, it's not like the animal is a part of the family. They are part of our families. And so I think that's part of the thing that police are banking on. And it's deeply traumatic, especially when so many of these encounters of pets being killed by the police are occurring in front of the children.
Kevin, we've got about 30 seconds left. Why don't you take us out with your final thoughts?
I'll just add quickly that there's an activist here in Chicago who was taking care of a stray dog, and the Chicago police decided that that stray dog needed to be shot and killed, took it upon themselves to say that it was a danger to the community and that they couldn't take care of that dog, and so shot it. And it wasn't a retaliation move, the activist said, but it just shows you, again, I think, the way they're using this to control communities.
I think that's exactly right. It's a control issue. It's a power issue. We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.